I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. The other day, I snapped a picture of my wife and our daughter at a train station. It was kind of a long wait for our train, and our kid was getting antsy, so my wife just picked her up and put her on her lap and suggested she take a break. And I've been looking at this picture all week long. In it, our daughter's little hand is resting on her mom's, and her tiny fingers sitting on my wife's fingers. And I just think, I love these two. And I love how much they love each other. And you know, I do my best to be a good dad, but my wife is an extraordinary mother. She parents with respect and thoughtfulness and care, and it makes me so happy to think that I get to have the rest of my life to see how these two people relate to each other as mother and daughter. And this week on the show, it's all about mothers and daughters. A chef whose mother cried when she was born. A chef whose restaurant is based on food passed on between mothers and daughters. And first, a visit with the duo who wrote a cookbook called Indianish. Priya Krishna is a young star of a food writer, and Ritu Krishna runs software development teams, is a terrific home cook, a self-taught sommelier, founded a South Asian film festival, and, oh yeah, she's Priya's mom. They wrote the book together to collect Ritu's recipes and tell the story of their family. And so, when we heard Ritu was in town visiting from Texas, we knew we'd have to get the two of them together in the kitchen. All right, so I'm not doing anything. I'm just standing here. You guys are going to make dahi toast.
Mm-hmm.
Priya, what's dahi toast?
Dahi toast is basically a griddled sandwich with a filling of yogurt spiced with onions and cilantro and jalapenos that's topped with tempered curry leaves and mustard seeds. And it is one of my all-time favorite foods.
Oh, cool.
It's basically like an Indian grilled cheese sandwich, and it's so much better. And I have it with ketchup, which is how I have my grilled cheese sandwiches. I realize not everyone has grilled cheese sandwiches with ketchup. But
oh, we have to make chutney too.
I mean, if you want, but you know.
But I'm good with the Heinz chutney.
I'm good chutney. With ketchup. Yeah, Heinz chutney.
Okay, so Ritu, we have in this bowl some beautiful plain whole milk yogurt.
Yep.
Right.
You just added some salt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then red onions.
Mm-hmm.
You can use yellow onions as well, but the red ones are my favorite.
Why is that?
They're just sweeter and they just taste better. They're not so pungent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And cilantro, chopped cilantro, and chopped green chilies.
Okay.
And you can adjust the green chilies based on your tolerance for green chilies.
But, you know, I always say, I feel like our spice tolerance is more than we think it is. Like, you can definitely handle one green chili. Do at least that much.
and
you're throwing down the gauntlet. You're just challenging people now.
Getting a little piece of green chili in between when you're, you know, taking mm-hmm. a bite
is nice.
It's nice.
It's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very
That is a great part of dahi toast is because you're getting all these like sort of warm, rich flavors, and then having like a like fresh, spicy note to cut through that is fantastic.
You were right. Yeah. A little bit more. Yogurt.
I was right.
Very good. Ah.
But this is like a lot of onion and cilantro in the bowl with the yogurt. It's not like a lightly seasoned.
No. Like, it's very aggressively seasoned.
Yeah, it's almost like. Like an egg salad, only with onions.
Yeah, it kind of looks like that.
It sort of looks like the consistency of egg salad at this point.
Can you taste it to make sure the salt is good?
Yeah.
And do you have a fresh pepper grinder?
Right here. My understanding of this dish is it's something that, you know, Indian parents will make when they don't have all that much in the fridge, you know, when they don't feel like putting together a sabzi and a dal, something they can... Mom, you're...
Sorry.
Sorry.
You can do it again.
You know, something that parents can just throw together. So, Mom, you're cracking the pepper. It just
instinct takes over sometimes.
Yeah. Okay. I will just keep my hands to myself.
I don't know. It's just a dish.
I mean, the inspiration for this exact dish came from a friend who made it for my husband and I. And since then, I started making it because my husband loved it. Mm. And then when the kids came around, I would make it every so often. And they started liking it.
So,
and it just kind of
it is just
went
so
from
good.
There.
I can't wait for you all to eat this. Like, it is just like the oily bread crunch of the toast and like the brightness and the herbiness of this yogurt situation, and then like the tempered curry leaves on top for crunch. It's just, it's so good. It's sort of like a really nice marriage. No, Mom.
Let me finish this. Then you can talk.
You're like really over pep. This is heavy pepper.
No, that's it. Now I'm just prepping the curry leaves, taking out any of the dried ones, bad ones, and then we'll make the chowk. And then our two key ingredients will be ready, and then it's just a matter of assembly.
Oh, Mom, did I look? I got a little chonk pot.
Oh,
look, isn't this nice?
This is very nice.
I got this Turkish coffee warmer from Amazon. My friend Reem, who runs a restaurant in San Francisco, she recommended it because she uses it to like heat up leftovers and sauces and to make coffee. But I was like, actually, this is perfect for chonk. And it has a little spout.
So for people who don't know, what's chonk?
Chonk is a seasoning. You put it on top for that additional layer of spices, you know, oil, all of the extra oomph that it adds to the dish.
Mm-hmm. But it's basically...
And there are a lot of different versions of it.
Yeah, but the basic principle is you're taking a fat, like oil or ghee, and toasting spices in it. And the spices infuse the ghee or the oil with flavor. The spices become more crunchy. They release their essential oils. They become more flavorful. It's just sort of adding like that... Like, I feel like what makes Indian food amazing is got all these layers of complexity, and chonk is sort of that final layer of richness and interest in a dish.
Yeah, yeah.
The only thing is, Priya, this is a little deep. Do you have something a little shallower?
No, this works. I got this. I got this for chonk.
No, I know that, but...
it works. I've done curry leaves in this. It works fine.
Okay, we'll give it a shot.
She has like a shallow butter warmer. That's what she uses. But
yeah, mine is much shallower.
I liked this because it was kind of multi-purpose.
I mean, what I like about it is that it's much safer for you.
As you'll see, this particular chonk really splatters. Like in the book, I kind of like give people a heads up. You know, you take it off the heat and then you add the curry leaves because they immediately start like popping like fireworks.
Mm.
I mean, you're basically like deep frying the curry leaves.
For people who haven't had curry leaves, how would you describe the flavor?
It's really, it's like grassy and herbaceous, but in a good way. Like, you know how like if you were to eat grass, there's like this very unpleasant vegetal flavor. This doesn't have any of that like vegetal flavor, but it still has that really pleasant earthiness. Yeah.
Like smelling it now, like rubbing it between my fingers, it's almost like toasted peanuts. A little bit like oniony or garlicky.
Yeah, toasted peanuts is good. Even like the mustard seeds, they emit this very strong peanutty fragrance.
Mm.
I like to point out that when I moved to New York, my mom made me Tupperware containers with the names of the spices written in Hindi and English and filled them up. And I just refilled these same containers.
So you have your little pot. Your oil is like smoking hot.
Yeah, and it sputters. It's like popping popcorn.
I just put in the mustard seeds, and now I'm adding.
It really, this is...
It really does pop.
Yeah, really. But and then it immediately crisps up.
So this is ready. And you can smell. That's the best
like
part.
Freshly buttered popcorn, yeah.
This is a beautiful chunk.
Good job. Good job, Mama.
Okay, now...
Here, why don't you stuff the sandwiches? I'll get the pan out.
And now we're basically just making like a grilled cheese, right?
Yeah.
Correct. I bought the sourdough bread from Whole Foods, but you can buy a regular sandwich sourdough bread as well.
But sourdough is
One of the variations that is mine that I love how it tastes with sourdough bread. You can make it with regular white bread. I've even tried making it with whole wheat bread.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband basically said, don't do it again. It doesn't taste as good.
Sourdough bread, just the tang of it just marries really nicely when you're putting the chonk over the top. You just need kind of that lighter note.
Yeah.
And you just start layering the yogurt, onion, cilantro, green chili mix onto it. Make sure that all the edges are nicely covered.
She's very particular about that.
And the layer is not too thick or too thin. Because if it's too thick, it starts oozing out like a little bit is okay, but not too much.
Here,
and we need to make sure that it's warm, the pan.
Oh, should I warm it now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And we can probably fit two.
Probably two, I think two is right. Okay, I'll just put this on medium heat for now. Usually for all of these interviews, I have to make the food. And it's really intimidating making my mom's food because I know that this will be going on the internet and my mom will be watching it and giving feedback. But this is amazing. I just get to watch my mom.
It's getting so much better. Priya, remember the days when you were recipe testing at home? I'd come home and there would be
a few smoked disasters. And my dad would have the steel wool and he'd be scrubbing a pot.
And he'd have this expression, Priya did it again. You can hear a little bit of the sizzle.
Yeah, see, they're definitely, this is hot enough. All right.
Here we go.
Here. And what is really amazing is that I feel like the idea of putting yogurt in a sandwich seems really weird and counterintuitive, but the yogurt, it sort of gets a bit thicker.
Because it gets absorbed, the liquid gets absorbed by the bread.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's almost like having like a tangy ricotta.
Oh, yeah, right.
It just gets like, it just thickens and dries a little bit, and then sort of gets infused with the flavor of the onions and the chilies and cilantro. It just all works.
Let's see how it's doing. Oh, perfect. Now, see that crispy?
Yeah, no, that's good. If my dad were here, he'd want it like almost burnt. That's sort of his style, mm-hmm. But we like it on the more golden side.
It's a little more oil in the pan after you flip the...
Right, to make sure that the other
side
has... Well,
you're putting on the chunk now?
Yeah, because the other side will get done, and that's it. That's how I
usually put the chunk when I transfer it to the plate.
Oh, this is how I do it.
Nice drizzle of the chunk. Yeah,
it looks so pretty.
You can really see the curry leaves.
Yeah, they get so nice and translucent when you... Yeah.
And I generally drizzle oil on the edges because they tend to be the drier... than rest of the toast, so it just helps make it a little bit more moist and tasty.
You are a very detail-oriented cook. I really appreciate that.
She definitely is, and I am not at all.
And then you take it out. I like to keep it such that it's not fully on a surface so that it doesn't get soggy. Oh.
The detail.
Wow. See, like that is
cooling rack.
Never.
Oh
yeah.
My! This is a very chefy move.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah, cooling.
We have a cooling rack. Do you want a cooling rack?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because then it won't be soggy when I cut it.
There you go.
There, perfect. So let me cut it so you can taste it.
It's super pretty.
Let me get the ketchup out.
Yeah. It's super beautiful. And here we go.
All right. Do you want to go first?
Yes.
No, you go first. You got to tell me if this is proper.
I mean. My mom's really the one who will say it's proper. And you can try it with or without ketchup, but I just don't think it's the dahi toast without ketchup.
This is
my dad in my opinion. My mom and my sister are team chutney.
We like green chutney.
That's so good.
Wait. Francis, just a minute. I'm going to take a picture of her eating. And send it to her dad.
I'm going to try a bite without the ketchup first. I'm sorry. Just because I want to see.
Sure.
Mm. Oh.
See, when I say oily bread crunch, I don't really know how to describe it, but...
That's delicious. At first, I thought, oh, yogurt, it's going to be really liquidy. Mm-hmm. But no, it totally sort of thickens up and it soaks into the bread.
With ketchup, it comes alive.
Oh, man. Ketchup is a move.
Right?
Ketchup is definitely the move.
Sweet, tangy, like, it's just...
Ooh!
Yeah.
Got a little bite of that chili.
Yeah. Put more ketchup for you.
Even better is when you mix ketchup with cilantro chutney, but ketchup by itself, I think, is just amazing.
Love it. Thank you for having us here. Thank you for being so perfectly mother and daughter. I cannot believe it.
We don't have to work at it. This is what we do.
Priya and Rithu Krishna are the authors of Indianish, Recipes and Antics from a Modern American Family. You can find that recipe for dahi toast at splendidtable.org. And coming up, we'll spend a little more time talking with the Krishnas about writing together, and then we'll talk with the chef Bonnie Frumkin-Morales of Kachka in Portland, Oregon. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. When we last saw our heroines, mother-daughter duo Rithu and Priya Krishna, we were all scarfing down their amazing grilled yogurt sandwiches. But then, we moved to the couch, and we talked about how their book, Indianish, came about. I started by asking Ritu what it was like cooking for Priya when she was growing up.
It was challenging, because since she was little, we would go to a restaurant, and she would order from the adult menu, because none of the things, macaroni and cheese and, you know, French fries, just didn't do it for her. And a similar theme, you know, prevailed at home. So when I was packing her lunch, she wanted some new and different things. My older daughter, she was happy with the same thing over and over every day. Peanut butter jelly sandwich, you know, yogurt, a fruit. That was the standard lunch. Priya, on the other hand, would say, hey, you know, Mom, I can't eat the same thing again and again, so you've got to give me something else. So Sunday night, we used to try and make something special. She would give me ideas. I appreciated some of it then, but sometimes sometimes it was a chore because, you know, I was trying to juggle a million other things and then trying to be creative in cooking. But I think, you know, her pushing me was good.
Yeah.
Because in the end, I think everybody ate well.
Yeah. Even though you had to actually do it.
Yeah.
But so how did you feel when she called you up one day and said, Mom, I want to write a book of your recipes?
Just to clarify, I told her after the book was sold. So it was more like, Mom, you're writing a book. You're writing a book with me.
That is true, because up until then, there were like many, many proposals that she had run by me and saying, you know, here is how I'm pitching it. These are some of the ideas. We helped brainstorm. And then one fine day, she's like, Mom, you have to write 100 recipes. Like, what?
Well, let me ask you this. I assume you're close with your mom, Priya.
Yes, I would say that.
Were you like, okay, let's work on this project every single day for 2 years, kind of close?
I mean... It's weird. I feel like there's a very different conception of mother-daughter relationships in, like, non-Western world versus the Western world. Like, I feel like the Western world, there's this sort of, like, Gilmore Girls style. Like, my mom is my best friend. I tell her everything.
Right.
Whereas my mom, for me, our closeness has always been, like, the deep, like, respect and admiration I have for her. And so, actually, like I feel like doing this book, like, my mom and I spend more one-on-one time than we really had spent in a long, long time.
Yeah. What were some of the things that surprised the two of you while talking to each other and working on this book together?
For me, it was how important it is to just ask your parents questions. Mm. As I've become a food writer, I've mined my parents for many stories and sort of explanations behind certain recipes. And I learned things about my mom that I never knew before. I learned things about my dad that I never knew before, my whole extended family. Like, I'd never asked my mom about, like, the moment when she met my dad. They had an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
And we'd never had, like, an in-depth conversation about that before.
It sounds like such a gift to have worked on this thing together.
And have it all codified, really, so that if I forget, I have a place where I can go and look it up, and all of my cousins can look it up, and hopefully my kids. Like, that's amazing. And Mom, I hadn't actually talked to you about, like, what it was like to see this book in real life and what, like, how you feel about the fact that I did this.
I love the fact that you did this. The big reason for me is just documentation of foods that you grew up with for forever and ever. And I see benefits from it because I see you cook these things. I follow you on Instagram, and every so often I see a dal show up, a sabzi show up. It's so heartwarming. I love it.
But is it weird to you seeing, like, you know, when I make these videos on Bon Appetit and people will make sag feta at home, they'll make dahi toast at home. Is that weird, mind-blowing? How does that feel, seeing people making the food that you kind of just made on a weeknight?
I love seeing people make those things because to me, that means they're going to be eating well. You know, these are people like you, like us, and if they're eating well, then that's a good thing.
Yeah. Ritu, what surprised you about this process?
I think I was, it took me a while to realize why she would ask me these random questions. Like, one time we were walking, And she started asking me all these questions about my life, you know, like how I met my husband and, you know, what it was like growing up and all of that. So I was really surprised. But then after a while, a theme began to emerge that she was asking me these things for a reason, because she was trying to understand where I came from, what I did, why I did certain things and so on, which was really great.
Was there anything that she asked you that you didn't want to talk about?
I don't think so. So far she hasn't asked me anything that I wouldn't want to share.
No. Yeah, no, I feel like, I mean, the one thing we don't talk about that much is your parents' death. I usually talk to Dad about that, but...
Mm. Yeah, it used to be difficult to talk about that, but I think I'm at a place now that I can.
Yeah.
Mm.
I lost both my parents in a car accident.
Oh, God.
Just like that. Just, you know, really, really, when they were in their 50s.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So it took us a while to get over that and get back to normal life.
But the silver lining is basically because of that, I grew up around all my mom's brothers, all my aunts, all my uncles, all my cousins. Because of that, my mom and her brothers just insisted on all of us being in the same place. And that's why we all ended up in Texas, and why I have this like unbelievable extended family that probably shaped my life more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously it was a tragedy, but maybe absent that, we wouldn't have all been in the same place.
Yeah. Well, thank you two so much for doing this. I know obviously for so many ways you did it for yourself, but I was so glad to have a part in just in reading your family stories, mm-hmm. and to be here talking with you is really special. Thank you.
Yeah.
Priya Krishna and Ritu Krishna are the authors of Indianish, Recipes and Antics from a Modern American Family. I've admired Bonnie Frumkin Morales of Portland's Katya for years. And not just because her food is super delicious, but also because she's one of the few chefs in the country highlighting what she thinks of as the matrilineal cuisine of Russia. Hey, chef, it's great to have you.
Hi, Francis. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you actually first start by telling us where the name Kachka comes from?
I would love to. Kachka is just a really important word for me personally. My father, when I was a kid, would tell me all these stories about our family. And for some background, my family immigrated from Minsk in Belarus in 1980. And so he would always tell me stories about growing up and about his mother, my grandmother, who I never got a chance to meet. And one of those stories was during World War II when she was in a ghetto in Belarus, and she escaped in the middle of the night before her whole family was exterminated. And she left with a 3-month-old baby in her arms in one of the coldest winters on record in October, and just traveled through the woods towards Russia, sort of away from the front. And along the way, there were so many harrowing experiences, but the one that I remember from as a kid was about her encountering a town warden, a starosta is what they're called. She was in town for provisions, and this guy was like, you're a Jew, you're not. Her story was that she was a Ukrainian peasant who, you know, was traveling to see her in-laws in Russia. And he's like, you're not Ukrainian, you're a Jew. And she, you know, asserted, no, that I am. And he's like, well, if you're Ukrainian, then how do you say duck in Ukrainian? In Russian, it's utka. And she obviously does not know Ukrainian. She knows Yiddish and Russian, maybe a little Belarusian. And she just crossed her fingers and hoped that it was the same. I mean, there's some overlap in all those languages. And so she said Kachka. And it turns out it actually is the same in Ukrainian, Belarusian, Yiddish. And I've also learned Polish. And he let her go. And so that story of all the others sort of stuck with me forever. And when we were thinking about opening the restaurant, this word just kept coming back to me.
Yeah. And you never met her, right? But do you cook any of the food that was passed down from her?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it involves a lot of conversations between my parents, and like a lot of the times, because, you know, cooking tends to go to the mother in the family, my dad, it's my dad's mom. So like often he'll end up calling up my aunt because she knows more about it, because, you know, the woman passes it on to the daughter. And so he'll get her involved and he'll get her recollections. And so it's really cool because we end up sort of learning together about things that maybe otherwise none of them would have recollected or thought, because as immigrants, I feel like you're always like trying to assimilate and not remember what you cooked back in the old country. Yeah.
But you describe the food you cook as a chef now as primarily food that's passed from mother to daughter, as you just said. And like, is the food you're cooking literally food that you remember your mother cooking for you, or did you learn from her? Do you ask her how to cook the dishes in the restaurant?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my mother, as a kid, it wasn't one of those situations where, like, I was, you know, on a chair next to her cooking. She's, like, such... I mean, I love you, Mom, but she's such a neat freak. And so, you know, even like me running through the kitchen with my hair down, I would get yelled at, be like, get your hair back, get out of the kitchen. But as an adult, and I got into food through other people, when I wanted to sort of go back to my roots, she's the first person I went to.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny, though, because I was talking to another chef once who's known for being super creative and innovative and makes, you know, dishes no one's ever seen before. And he was talking to me about this thing he called the pancake problem. Well, what's a pancake problem? He's like, well, I can make my food, and like, if you like it, great. If you don't like it, fine. But I don't ever suffer from the pancake problem, which is, it doesn't matter how great a chef I am. If my pancakes don't taste just like your mom's pancakes, my pancakes are terrible.
Yeah.
I thought that was so funny. It's like, I'm like, is that why you actually make food no one's ever seen before? It's like, yeah, because no one can ever come and say, like, this doesn't taste like how it's supposed to taste.
Oh my God, I love that.
Right? Well, do you have customers who come and eat the food because this is, they think of this as being quote unquote traditional food, or this is the food that your mom cooks. So if it doesn't taste like my mom's food, then it's wrong. Like, do people, do you get that? Do you hear that?
Oh my God, all the time. You know, it's so interesting because Russia, so great. Let's just get a little history out of the way. Like, the Soviet Union is massive. It was like 1/6 of the world landmass. And I say Russia, I actually mean the Soviet Union, because that's when my parents immigrated, it was the Soviet Union. And clearly somebody from a town outside of Minsk who makes golubtsy, which are cabbage rolls, their version is obviously going to be different than somebody who's in, you know, maybe Kazan, central Russia. But they both make cabbage rolls, right? And so, yeah, people come in wanting a taste of their youth or their history, and they have something. They'll order a golubtsy. I brought that up specifically because that's the one. You know, I make cabbage rolls exactly like my mother does, except, you know, these days she's trying to eat lean, so she has like chicken and turkey in hers, and I use a mixture of lamb and beef and pork. But other than that, they are literally the same. I have not changed a thing about them. And that's the one that we most often get from Russians or people from the former Soviet Union. And they'll be like, this is not golubtsy. I don't know what this is. And I'm like, well, I mean, I literally just like this just gave you what my mother made and her mother made. But OK. But at the same time, we will literally have people in tears over them, which shows that for some people, there's that connection. And so when we make those connections, that's like what I live for. I mean, I had no idea that you could do that in a restaurant, and that sort of reaction has become something that's like a driving force for me, because if I can just bring back the memory of a lost grandmother for just 2-3 people in the whole existence of Kachka, then I feel like what better reason is there to exist as a restaurant?
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Chef.
Oh my God, of course.
Bonnie Frumpkin-Morales is the author of Kachka, A Return to Russian Cooking. You can find her recipe for her mother's 3-layer condensed milk cake at splendidtable.org. It's kind of too obvious to even say that our lives will be shaped by our parents and our own children, but when I watched Asma Khan's episode on the show Chef's Table, I was literally crying at her stories of both her family and the family she's made at her London restaurant, Darjeeling Express. You should really watch it. I highly recommend it. And we're delighted to have her with us today. Welcome, Chef.
Thank you very much.
Asma, so there is an intense moment in your story. You've said that your mother cried when you were born. Why is that?
Because it is part of this whole cultural divide in my society. In South Asia, the preferred sex of a child is always the male. The male is seen as the true heir. And girls are seen as a burden. It's not just the burden of getting them married, but protecting their integrity, you know, making sure that no one gossips about them. There's such a huge onus about honor and how girls are linked to the family honor that it is the biggest liability possible in families when you have more than one girl. Because not only do you need to marry, get two girls married off, it also means there is that fear that you may not have an heir to your family, which is doom and gloom. I mean, it's actually got massive economic connotations in some families if you don't have a boy. Because actually, inheritance law means that the girls don't inherit property. It will go to a cousin of the girls, a male cousin. So it's quite serious when a family doesn't have a boy. And I think that when a second girl arrives, it is devastating for the family because that hope that they all had that, okay, first one being a girl, fine, we'll live with it. The second one being a girl is devastating. It's also the fact that no family wants a lot of girls because very expensive to get married off. But then the other thing is everyone needs that boy to carry the family name. The family honor is linked to, you know, what the boy does. And family assets pass on just to the boy. The girls get a minimal amount.
Yeah. And so when you were growing up, how did you react to that situation? Were you aware of that?
I wasn't aware of the entire, gamut of problems that come with being a female in my society. I just knew that everybody was extremely upset when I was born and my mother grieved. It bothered me a lot. It bothered me a lot because I felt unwanted and maybe not respected. And what I tried to do was to pretend that I loved everybody a lot. Some of my aunts I knew would always mock, you know, me being a girl, tease me that no one would marry me, tell me that I was dark-skinned. So I was very made to feel sometimes that maybe, you know, I am this huge liability the family is stuck with. But I refused to allow this to break me. I used to visualize myself like a bamboo that, you know, used to grow in my backyard, that when the wind blew, the bamboo bent, but it never broke. I was not going to break because people had their biases. And I convinced myself that one day I was going to become someone very exceptional, someone brilliant. I used to close my eyes and visualize my name in lights, you know, like you see in Hollywood. So in Broadway, you know, I would imagine my entire name in lights. It's very hard if you're not from this particular culture to understand how deep-rooted the bias is. You know, people pass comments when they see girls that, you have girls. It's like watering the neighbor's plants, implying that all the resources you're putting into the girl, somebody else is going to benefit. It's a very strange culture where, you know, women are worshipped as goddesses, but our birth is lamented. It's hard to understand, you know, when we give life, our life is not celebrated.
We'll be back with more from Asma, and America's Test Kitchen has advice on how to actually cook with young kids. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back with the chef Asma Khan from London's Darjeeling Express. You mentioned earlier you would sometimes picture your name in lights and you'd want to become someone exceptional. And clearly you have now as a chef. But before you became a chef, you had to learn to cook. And so you went actually back to your mother's home, right? Yes. Did she teach you how to cook?
Yes, my mother taught me how to cook. My mother's a great cook. And, you know, in her whole family, she's the best cook, better than my grandmother. And she understood I was in pain. I was really unhappy. I was finding it incredibly difficult. And I eventually told
her. You were an adult then?
That, you know, yes, I was an adult. And, you know, I hadn't learned how to cook because, you know, the presumption is, you know, I come from a family where we get married within your own family because you need to marry royalty. So I just presumed I would get married into a palace and have lots of servants cooking for me. So I wasn't going to waste my time learning how to cook. I just like to eat. So I had learned how to cook. The fact that I had an arranged marriage with my husband, who was an academic teaching at Cambridge University, and between us meeting for the first time and me leaving for Cambridge was 3 months. I spent the entire 3 months eating and getting all my clothes ready for my wedding. I didn't bother. I didn't even, at that time, it didn't occur to me that I'm going to this place where I may have to cook. I don't know. I didn't plan for my life in the West. I just got very excited. I'm getting married. I was so happy. All the people told me I'd never get married. I was like, yay, I finally, someone has agreed to marry me. I'm getting married. And yeah, so I just was so excited. I kind of missed the bit where I should have figured out that I don't know how to cook.
And what was that like going back to your mother's house as an adult to learn to cook?
It was actually very emotional. I felt that she was trying to embrace me again, to kind of raise me again. I felt she was literally like handing over to me everything that she knew, almost like a sacred gift to me, the recipes. And I was very aware, acutely aware, that she was doing this because she was trying to make amends for everything. She wanted to see if I could take this somewhere else. Because she herself had a food business. And her dream was always to open a restaurant. This is something I've never said anywhere else. When my mother and I would talk, she would always say, my dream was to open a restaurant. But I did. I opened the restaurant she always dreamt of. And it's so
amazing.
Yeah, that when the first time she walked into Darjeeling Express, she told me, yeah, finally, I have a restaurant too. I said, yeah, because every dish in there is your recipe. It was so sweet. It was very emotional. You know, I felt overwhelmed watching her walk into Darjeeling Express.
So then you befriended this group of South Asian women who are not all Indian, but all from South Asia. And you decided you wanted to cook together. Tell me about that.
Yes, because the first time I met the first woman in that group was a nanny in the school where my kids went, where most of the families there are European. And I saw the children she was looking after were European. And I realized that, you know, on Sunday she has nowhere to go. So I realized, my God, I was like this. I was lost and empty. I had no friends. And I could see in her eyes myself. I could see myself, you know, the Cambridge days of complete isolation. And I invited her to my house. But once that happened and they started coming to my home, you know, she bought her friend and her friend then got another friend. And so we became this big group of mainly nannies and the cleaners from the hospital were very close to the school, who, again, all of them didn't work on Sundays, but they had nowhere to go. So they hung around in my house. And when I started doing supper clubs, they offered to cook with me. They didn't know any of the dishes, but they were very good at prep. They washed up. The worst thing about cooking is washing up. And they were doing this because for them, this was a way to eat a lot of leftovers. There were, you know, I mean, I'm a paranoid Indian chef. I cook like double of what I need. So there used to be so much leftover. So they used to literally feast all night and watch Indian cable TV in my kitchen. So it was like this kind of big binge party. So it's so important because this is a relationship. You know, India is a class and caste-ridden society. These are women, people who you would not sit on the same table and eat with these people because of the divisions that we have in our society. But we are united by the emptiness of being immigrants in a foreign land, and we're united by our love for food. And also the fact that we know that actually we're all the same. All these superficial differences of class, you know, education, caste, are so irrelevant when we all hurt the same way and we all want the same things.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And now you have kids. Have you taught them to cook?
My younger one likes pasta and he likes chicken nuggets. I've completely failed as a mother with my younger one.
Oh, no.
Yes. It's my great disgrace. And I had publicly humiliated in his school because the first complete sentence my son wrote, my mama is a yucky cook, full stop.
Oh, God.
And the school head called me. I thought my son had gone and got into a fight. And there was this entire staff there holding up this piece of paper. And one of them said, see, he used the punctuation as well. Oh my God, I could have died. He wrote that. My mama is a yucky cook. That child is going to just embarrass me my whole life. My older one actually loves food. And I am absolutely sure he is going to be a better cook than me. He has an amazing palate. He, you know, if he hasn't watched us cook, he eats dishes that my mother has made and I have made, and he identifies correctly what my mother made. And I know my food is so close to what Ammu makes, but he can tell me, you didn't make this, your mother made this. And he's brilliant. He's, you know, I'll watch him sometimes, you know, when he sits around the kitchen, you know, watching me cook. And I see his eyes and I think, you know, he is just absorbing all this in. And one day this boy is just going to take off because he has that ability in him. And he's much loved by all the team in my kitchen, who all call him an Indian word, which is Chota Malik, which means the young owner. They already have, you know, they've anointed him as the crown prince in some ways because they call him the young owner. So, yes, he might be the future of Darjeeling Express.
Yeah. How old are your children?
My older son is 19 and my younger one is 14.
Life is complicated, huh? Parenting is definitely complicated.
Yeah, parenting is complicated. And anyone who thinks that this is like, you know, people ask me, you know, is it hard to run a business? I said, no, it's hard having two teenage boys and a husband who absolutely will. My husband calls me 11 o'clock at night. I said, what's for dinner? In like peak service time. I think, has he forgotten I'm running a restaurant? Yeah, so everything is going really well with my business. I'm trying to grapple with dealing with children and my home life.
I think we all feel that way. Thank you so much, Jeff.
You're very welcome.
Asma Khan's new book is Asma's Indian Kitchen. And she left us with a recipe for Keema Sua Pulao, spiced ground meat with dill rice, and it's one of her picky son's favorite dishes. You can find it at splendidtable.org. You know that Rolling Stones song, Mother's Little Helper? Well, yes, I know. The song is not really about kids helping out with dinner. In fact, it's kind of about the antidote to the nightmares that can induce. But America's Test Kitchen has real advice on how to make cooking with little kids fun and delicious. Here's Molly Birnbaum talking with our very own Sally Swift.
Hey, Molly, I have brought you in for a reason, because I want to talk to you about the fantasy versus the reality of cooking with children when you're a mother. Do you have anything to weigh in on with that?
Well, there is a little bit of a difference between those two, that is for sure. But I personally love cooking with my kid and kids in general. So I think there's a lot to talk about here.
Is there really any proof that it's good to cook with your kids?
For sure. There is a lot of evidence. Research has shown that getting kids involved in cooking or gardening or grocery shopping for that matter makes them more willing to try new foods. So getting them invested in the process of food and where it comes from and how it grows and how you treat it in the kitchen makes them more familiar with it and makes it more exciting and palatable to try new flavors, which I know can be a battle for parents of kids of many different ages. And right. I found that to be very true in my own household, for sure. And I think in general, cooking with kids is a wonderful way of teaching them about so much, not just about food. I think food is a wonderful window into talking about smell and taste and what you feel about something. Is it good? Is it bad? It's also a great way to learn about math, everything from counting to measuring. It's a great way to learn about culture because we can eat food from so many different cultures. And then it's also great to use as a way to explore art and what you can do to make your food look good or not good or however you want to play with it. There's so many things you can do with kids and food in the kitchen.
I find it really comforting that not only cooking but grocery shopping and gardening is helpful, too, to get them moving. You know, that is actually really great information. Okay, so I would expect that when you think about cooking with kids, you really have to focus on the age of the kid. So tell me let's take on the toddler, since that is in your sweet spot. What would you suggest we do with a toddler in the kitchen?
Yeah, for sure. So age makes a huge difference in kids' abilities and attention span when it comes to cooking in the kitchen. For toddlers, we think a lot about having recipes that are very hands-on and very fun and have short, doable, sensory parts for the toddlers to take on because they have shorter attention spans. I think that's just part of the deal with toddlers. So I like them to squish things, roll things, stir things, mix things, things that they can really get in there with their hands and have fun doing.
Unlike doing Christmas cookie cutouts, which is about the worst thing to do with a toddler ever, and you do it again and again.
Nothing frustrating, nothing that takes a really, really long time, and they have to do every single possible aspect of it. It's also great if they can taste things along the way.
Yeah. So do you have a recipe that you love that you guys have worked through for a toddler?
One of my favorite recipes that we developed for our new baby and toddler cookbook is hand-squished roasted tomato sauce. I just love the name, first of all, but it also says a lot about how you do it, which is taking vine-ripe tomatoes, you cut them in half, and then your toddler, or let's be real, anyone of any age can have fun doing this, squishes those tomato halves. And so you're getting rid of the seeds and all the excess moisture in the tomato halves. So hand squished. And then you put your hand squished tomatoes on a baking pan and you roast them for about 25 minutes, which makes them nice and caramelized and the flavor concentrates. So then when you whiz them in the food processor to create a sauce, you have a really flavorful sauce and you didn't have to worry about a saucepan or the top of the stove. It's delicious.
I love the idea of squishing and I can just see the debris all over the place.
I'm not saying that these recipes are going to keep your kitchen clean, but they will definitely be fun.
Okay, so let's go to the next level up. So what would you do for an older kid, say someone who's like, you know, between 8 and 10-ish or 12-ish?
For sure. So one of our biggest concentrations that we're doing here at America's Test Kitchen Kids is creating recipes for this middle grade level, the 8 to 12-ish. And what we're going for there is really figuring out recipes that can empower kids to feel like they can go into the kitchen and they can cook something and they can totally do it. So recipes that are doable from beginning to end for these slightly older kids. And one of the things that we did, which is really interesting from an America's Test Kitchen standpoint, is we really changed how we write recipes when we're writing them for kids. Instead of just having all the ingredients listed and then going straight into how you make the food, we're sectioning it off. So first, prepare your ingredients. So we're trying to set it up so kids are mising, so to say, the term for getting everything ready before you start cooking. So you're doing all your chopping, you're doing all your measuring of all of your ingredients before you actually start cooking. It's something that makes cooking so much easier, and I wish I had been doing for a lot longer.
That is really, really interesting. So what recipes do you like to pull out for that age group?
One of my favorite recipes for this age group is rice noodle bowls with pork and scallions. It's on our website right now. And it's a delicious meal. It's rice vermicelli noodles with sautéed pork, slightly pickled cucumbers and scallions on top. Every step is pretty simple. The rice vermicelli noodles are super easy to make because you basically, they're so tiny and thin, you just plop them into water that had been boiled and let them sit for 5 minutes. And when it all comes together, it looks beautiful. It has kind of interesting flavors, and it's something that kids can be so proud of. We've actually had some of our kid recipe testers send us in photos of themselves after they made this dish, and the look of pride on their face is just so amazing.
I love that. And then they get to step in and cook for their mother for change, right?
Exactly. Yeah, have your kids cook for you.
That's
great.
Exactly right. What a concept. Hey, Molly, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Birnbaum is the editor of America's Test Kitchen Kids. You can find those recipes for hand-squished tomato sauce and rice noodle bowls with pork and scallions at splendidtable.org. You can listen to all of our podcasts. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get them. You can also subscribe to our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. Sign up, splendidtable.org. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.